everyone, and welcome to Upzoned, your weekly look inside the conversations we're having behind the scenes at Strong Towns about the big news stories from the week. Each week, we select one story from the world of policy, building, infrastructure, economics, you name it, anything that touches the Strong Towns conversation, and we upzone it. And my name is Kia, and I am here with our president, Chuck Marone. How are you doing today, Chuck?
I'm doing fantastic. I got home from Erie, Pennsylvania, like late last night, and I got up here and it's gorgeous. So yeah, can't complain about being home in Minnesota.
Very good. Well, this week I actually selected our story to Upzoned, and it's one that I think is pretty interesting. It is from CityLab by an author named Derek Thompson, and it is called How Manhattan Became a Rich Ghost Town. And I'm a little nervous to talk about this one in some ways because behind the scenes at Strong Towns, we talk about New York City in sort of a peculiar way. Here's this city that ostensibly has a super productive development pattern. You know, to use every buzzword in the book, it is dense. It is, the roads are right scaled. There's robust public transit. People are getting around on all kinds of modes of transportation besides the car. And yet we still see that it has some problems. I know that Chuck, you told me in the past that you're kind of hesitant to talk about Manhattan in the context of the Strong Towns conversation, but I thought maybe this article, which parts of it I like, parts of it I take some issue with, might be a good springboard to talk about the New York City problem, as I call it in my head. What were your reactions to this piece?
Yeah, it's interesting because I do struggle with New York. It is unlike any other city in North America. And, you know, I've spent a great deal of time there. My friend Ian Rasmussen is like a, you know, cultural tour guide of New York, is showing me every building and all the stories behind it. If we think about the
core, he's on our board.
Yeah. If we think about the core Strong Towns message and this idea of having enough private wealth to sustain the public obligations, just from a that ratio standpoint, New York, like clearly, in almost all of it, it meets that test. It's very interesting because this article talked about Manhattan as a rich ghost town. And I have noticed this too. When you go, there are all these kind of vacant spots where you would otherwise think, like, why isn't there a store here? I mean, there's tons of people, there's tons of stuff going on. Why isn't there a place here? Why is this sitting vacant? And it's not like it's a, you know, an odd thing here or there, or like, you know, you run across a vacant parking spot and you're like, wow, in this busy city, a vacant spot. There's a certain amount of turnover, so you expect a little bit of vacancies. No, this is more widespread. And I think the article actually said, what, 20% of Manhattan's street retail is vacant? Yeah. Or about to become vacant. That's a huge number. And that represents literally billions and billions of dollars of real estate. I found that to be fascinating. And I'd like to get into their like explanation for what's going on, because I found it really, really lacking. I don't know if that's where you wanted to go, but
it kind of was.
It did seem like off to me. Okay, go ahead. I'll let you take the lead on that.
Specifically, when I was reading through this article, I kept thinking back to a piece you wrote, Chuck, which I think for me, the best Strong Towns pieces, certainly my favorite Strong Towns pieces, are ones that take a phenomenon and say, actually, here's a pretty simple reason you've never considered for why this would be. And your article about commercial real estate storefronts, I think it was specifically about Washington, D.C., why in a city that's pressed for so much, so hard for housing, isn't just converting these giant vacant commercial real estate into, you know, small apartments, subdividing it for, you know, like maybe $100,000 and getting that land back into productive use. Why on earth landlords don't do it? And the insight from that article was really interesting. And it talks about how that's just not how financing works in the world of commercial real estate. Do you think that applies in New York City as well? And could you take us through some of the arguments of that article for people who haven't read it?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where, you know, I mean, I don't know this author. I'm sure he's a swell guy. But I feel like this is where the urbanist conversation gets kind of silly to me and becomes one of these you know, more kind of gut reaction, touchy-feely things, as opposed to like, this is how the world works. Because what they say in the article is that, you know, the these places are empty because the rent's too high, as if like that's a reason. In a supply-demand like marketplace, like the rent's high just is a given. The second one is that, well, Amazon is forcing all these vacancies, which I think the idea that those two don't counteract each other just is kind of like basic like economics 101 illiteracy. So let's walk through what I see from a finance standpoint going on. If you go out and build a commercial building, you do it today with lots of financing. You're not taking cash you have, because that would be, in our age of like hyper leverage, that would be a really silly thing to do. Whatever cash you have, you use to leverage and buy even more stuff. And so these buildings are owned by people who own many, many commercial real estate ventures. And what happens is, when you go and get the loan from the bank, you say, here's how much commercial real estate rents for in this market. And thus, here's going to be the value of this building. Think of it as making your payment. So you say, I can go out and I can get, you know, this much money every month. And then that amount of money will turn around and I'll be able to make the loan payment on this bank. And so the bank says, okay, we've done comparables and we've looked at this and we agree with your numbers. We'll loan you up to 80% of that amount that you could afford. You know, so you've got some equity in play and what have you. If you go out in the marketplace then, and understand, commercial loans are done with like 3-year, 5-year, at the most 7-year with a balloon on the end. So you have a short-term financing thing. The more risk, the shorter the term. So a lot of these places in New York are financed in 3-year and 5-year increments. If you go out and you can't get those rents, when you have to go after the 3 years or 5 years and refinance that, you have to go out and say, you know, here's what I've actually done. Here's what the rents are that I can get. And let's just say for round numbers, it's 50% less. The bank, when they refinance, will say, well, your property's worth 50% less than what you said. You know, if you can only get 50% the rents, it's worth 50% less. And so we will only loan you 80% of that 50% less. You know, we're gonna loan you a lot less money. You have to, at that point, come up with the cash difference to pay off that loan. It basically forces you into insolvency. And so what happens is that businesses will do, you know, landlords will do crazy things. Like they'll say, we'll give you a 5-year lease at $10,000 a month. But we'll give you the first 3 years free. Yeah. Now, you could just say, you know, we'll reduce the lease by 60% and do that monthly. They won't do that because they can always go to the bank and say, well, the first 3 years was a teaser to get them in at this higher rate. And now they're locked in on this higher rate. Thus, our property should be valued at that higher rate. When the reality is like, you're making far less money. The property generates less than what you said. So what happens is, it is actually better for them from a cash flow standpoint to let this building sit and not be occupied than it is to rent it at a lower rate that would ultimately force them to take a ton of cash out of their pocket the next time they have to go refinance. That is a byproduct of our centralized financial system and how we have chosen to build these buildings. And my friends in New York who say, or Washington, D.C. or San Francisco, these big cities who say, you know, we're kind of immune from the strong downs problems. You say, Chuck, you know, we don't have those kind of things happening here. Look at all the growth we've got. Look at all the investment we got. Look at all the cranes in the air building stuff. And my response is like, if you're saying you don't have any like Ponzi finance going on, that you don't have this kind of, you know, huge, artificial inflation of your property values by this huge inflow of money that's coming in, that's all borrowed cash, I don't think you quite grasp what's going on. And to me, these vacant buildings point that out in a clear way. You have ostensibly really high rent, yet you have these vacant buildings. That's a market condition that does not make sense and should not persist at the levels that it does. The only reason it does is because of the goofy way we finance stuff.
Yeah, that's something that when I read it, it blew my mind. And, you know, you said at one point in that comment, Chuck, that, you know, this is just a deal-breaking financial illiteracy that people don't understand this. I both agree. And I also want to point out that I know a ton of smart people who don't know that about commercial real estate, because why would you if that's not your field? It's so much simpler and so much easier to think, oh, well, landlords are holding out because they're greedy for a bigger tenant who can pay them more money.
That's the third thing in this article. Yeah. I got to that. I just started laughing because the guy who wrote the article said, well, the first reason is because rent's really high. The second reason, because Amazon is undermining all businesses. And then the third reason is because developers are greedy. And I'm like, could you be any lazier in your analysis? Like that, that is a silly thing, right? Sure, they're greedy. I don't even deny that. But your greed is not going to have you sit and leave a building vacant for years and years and years when there are people out there who will pay you something for it. Greed would do the exact opposite.
Right. Exactly. But it's challenging as a layman or even as a journalist or someone working at a pretty sophisticated level of economic intelligence to understand that mechanism of just a mortgage. I want to go to reason number two that you've been sort of dancing around which is that the article points out that New York is a ghost town insofar as the only things you're going to see at street level these days pretty much are going to be restaurants and places that provide services like hair salons, nail salons, because Amazon has killed street front retail. We are on record, you and I, Chuck, of disagreeing about this issue a little bit. It's a friendly disagreement. And we did a podcast about it about a year and a half ago. I'm still working here. So obviously we haven't completely torn each other to shreds on this. Yeah. We do. We do. Tell me what fault you find with that side of the argument.
Well, I don't necessarily find fault with it. I mean, I think, you know, you certainly have that impact. I think, you know, even in smaller cities than New York, it's even more pronounced in many ways. New York has a lot of bodegas and a lot of other kind of street level kind of service retail, like the Walgreens and the CVSs. I mean, these are chains as well. Because a lot of what is consumed at these places is convenience stuff. Like I need toothpaste and I need it now and I'm not going to order it off of Amazon. Even though in New York you can get 1 hour delivery, which, you know, Ian has told me is just insane. The idea you can order something and they'll show up within an hour and they don't even charge you like a delivery fee. It's just crazy. I think that there's a lot of truth to that. Whether that is impacting the amount of space, I don't have a sense of. I don't really know. If that's true, it should be having a huge downward pressure on, the rents that can be charged because there would be less demand for it. There also should be a huge increase in essentially like warehouse space. There's an article that I read today about Walmart and how Walmart is shifting their business model. They're not building hardly any super centers anymore. They're building like a dozen this year. And this is when they used to build hundreds a year. Part of that is because they're built out, but part of it is because that business model just doesn't make any sense. They're actually in a place now where they're getting into more delivery like Amazon, more drive-in and pick up. So like you can order your stuff from Walmart and then drive into the parking lot and they'll actually come out and just load it in your car. What that means is that like a Walmart building is becoming less a retail place and more of just a warehouse. So I don't know. I mean, what's going on with warehouse space in New York? That I don't have a sense of. I have a good friend who owns a warehouse and runs it in New York City. He does like dental products around the country. He brings them in on a boat and then breaks them down and ships them out. I don't know if his value has gone up or not. I could ask him. I'm sure that Amazon is having an effect, though. I just don't have a sense of how deep it is.
It's a challenging problem. And for background of people who might not have heard Chuck and I's conversations about this earlier, my feelings about Amazon are very much shaped by the fact that I am an author. I wrote a novel. So books are my industry, and that's where Amazon started. And I worked in an independent bookstore for the better part of 4 years. And I recognize in a lot of ways that the kind of retail businesses that this article from CityLab says don't exist in New York are not just retail businesses, at least when you're talking about the bookstores, you know, and things like that of the world. They double as community centers. And will they ever be able to compete on volume in a landscape like New York? No. Like, I remember one of the comments that you had for me and that others had for me, Chuck, when we had this conversation originally is, isn't it, you know, the bookstores like responsibility to adapt in some ways? And how can we have the level of fine-grained street-level detail while also recognizing that the realities of retail and shipping are changing, and we're not necessarily going to go to the bookstore to buy a book every time we buy a book. We're going to get it in our house. For me, I'm really interested in seeing how we could bring bookstores into more of a nonprofit model. I know a few bookstores and other retail businesses, frankly, that run, you know, a nonprofit out of the back and then a retail store in the front. If we recognize that these things are a common public good and that needs some subsidy, maybe that's the way to go. But to sort of circle back around on this article, I'm curious what solutions you see for the problems this article puts forward, Chuck. Do you think that we need to change our financing system so that commercial real estate developers don't have the incentive to let buildings sit vacant for years on end? Do we need to move into more nonprofit retail models? Like, what kind of comes to mind when you read an article like this about how to fix it?
What comes to mind is just that we're screwed. You know, like I don't know how to say it other than that. So understand what this is. What we have done is that on a national macro level, we have said that we want to have a ton of growth. We need more growth. Our economy needs to grow. We need growth. Growth creates jobs. Growth is good. Growth solves problems. Grow, 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 grow. And we really haven't bothered to think about or understand the implications of that at the local level. Complex adaptive systems react and have feedback loops, and things happen. When we have growth from the top down, engineered from the top down, what you lose is that kind of fine-grained interaction at the local level. You just overwhelm it. And so, yeah, I'd say, you know, what needs to happen? Our financial system needs to change. It tried to collapse and go away in 2008. We didn't allow it to. We extended it out further. I think the reason we did that is because the idea of having it collapse, even though it's not viable today and it's causing all these bad things, the idea of having it collapse is very scary. We were told in 2008, if we let the financial system collapse, we would have no food on the grocery shelves within 72 hours. That seems like a really fragile system. So yeah, I would like to see finance be more localized. I would like to see local bankers who have more of a sense of the retail market, not basically your mom's pension fund routing money through a hedge fund, buying, you know, commercialized debt that's been collateralized in a CDO. I mean, the way we finance it now is so opaque that like no one knows what they're actually buying when they buy this stuff. And the money just has to go somewhere. It goes into these crazy things. If you had a local banker who understood the local real estate scene, had their own skin in the game, their own money at risk, not only are they going to work with the property owner to get the buildings rented out, but they're not going to allow the crazy overbuilding to begin with. If you don't allow the overbuilding, here's what happens. You're going to have a lower growth rate. You're not going to have as many cranes. You're not going to have as much stuff going on. And we, New Yorkers, Americans, politicians, our economy, our economists, we want the growth rate. And so we've been willing to do kind of these crazy things. We read these stories about how in China, they're so, you know, they're so obsessed with growth and they have to keep the growth rate up or their economy is going to collapse and then they're going to have social upheaval that they go out and build entire cities that are vacant and unoccupied just for the act of keeping people employed and building with them. And we laugh at them. We're like, oh, those silly Chinese, what do they know? They're a bunch of communists. They don't get markets. They don't know how it works. And then we just ignore the fact that we've done the exact same thing. We just are maybe a little more sophisticated at hiding it than they are.
Wow, that's a huge bummer, but really important food for thought. And I feel like that's how a lot of our podcast ends.
I mean, I think we could do, I mean, it's possible to have really good, robust local finance that creates growth in our cities. But that growth is going to be balanced with other things like stability, which is also a really important function. When you say stability is not important, growth is. Ultimately, you run into this problem where you no longer have stability, and we're getting to that point. You know, the rent is too damn high in New York. I agree. It's crazy. It's distorted. You've got all these vacancies. How can this persist? It only persists because our main goal is not some balancing or harmonizing of these different things. It is just one thing, growth, GDP growth, macro unemployment statistics. And that's a really bad way to run a city.
Definitely. You know, before we go to the down zone, one more thought occurred to me. I've been thinking about Derek Avery during this conversation. He was one of our speakers at our Plano gathering. And he is a really interesting guy. He is a real estate developer. And he had a really fascinating idea about how to develop commercial real estate or redevelop vacant commercial real estate in Dallas, which is that he's not even going to deal with the banks. He is starting, I hope I can say this on the record, but was in the process maybe of starting a private equity firm. And the reason he said he wanted to do it was because he was like, I can't find people who want to make money with me. I can't find people who want to put these vacant buildings back into productive use in the short term. They would rather, you know, stick to this model that isn't serving communities, isn't in fact harming them. Do you think there's a place for private equity in this localized banking prescription you're given to cities?
I think it's the only thing that's really going to work. I had Jace Wilson from Neighborly, the CEO of Neighborly on the Strong Towns podcast, I think last week or the week before. And here's a person who has looked at the municipal bond market and said, this is broken with all the wrong incentives and we can do this differently. And has gone out and created a platform and a service to do that, where local people can invest in local projects in their own community. These are municipal projects now, you know, building stuff in the park and fixing a road and what have you. I think we can do the same thing for finance of buildings and neighborhood reconstruction and all the things that today have to be done in this kind of hyper-centralized, does it meet the Fannie and Freddie checkboxes? Does it fit the real estate investment trust, you know, goals and prospectus kind of way, which has created for us this homogenous monoculture of places. If we can get back to empowering that local finance, and Derek is on the front edge of this, and I think the guy is awesome. Yeah. I think we can do a lot of good, a lot of good.
Agreed.
It's a little bit like, and I'm going to say this and I don't want to offend people because I'm not sure that this has worked out this way, but like one of the theories behind like charter schools, I was involved in starting a charter school here in my hometown. One of the thoughts behind charter schools is that public schools are so like broken and bureaucratic and like let's create an alternate system. And I get why that's controversial. I mean, part of why public schools in some places don't work is because of lack of funding. So taking funding from them is not exactly making it better. Like I get all those arguments. But I think when we look at finance, to me that there is something to be said about, like, I don't think we can really reform this system. I think the system today that we have of these huge, you know, too big to fail institutions with all the wrong, like perverse incentives, with decisions on what's going to be financed here in my local city being made in Washington, D.C. and New York, I think that that system is broken and probably needs to be allowed to fail and go away. That's really, really scary unless you have built up and created a parallel alternate system that can step in and take its place and actually function. And that's where I think we should be putting our energies, is to getting that going. Tom Fisher, a professor at the University of Minnesota, a genius guy in their College of Art and Design, once told me that, you know, we're basically dinosaurs who can see like the meteorite coming, and we should be putting our energy not into like surviving that. We should be putting in our energy into seeding mammals. In other words, seeding like the next generation of an ecosystem. And I actually think that that's a good metaphor for how to think about this.
Yeah. I was about to say that I tricked you into ending on a positive note, but then you brought up the end of the world. So never mind. So, you know, rewind a minute and hear the solutions and hear that there's hope and you'll feel good. Let's go to the down zone. I can never decide whether I want that to be a verb or a noun in this particular podcast, but the down zone is where we talk about what we've been reading, listening to, watching that is completely unrelated to Strong Towns in any way, at least. We didn't prepare for this podcast. Chuck, what have you been enjoying lately?
I had someone in a comment in my Monday post about Hilton Hotels recommend a book called Finite and Infinite Games. And it's a concept that I've been kind of, you know, puzzling back and forth in my brain for a few years. Never knew this book exists. I'm completely enthralled. It's a finite and an infinite game is, think of it this way. You know, you play like a baseball game. It's got a beginning. It's got an end. There's rules. An infinite game would be like life, right? Like it never ends. Like you're building your city is an infinite game. There is no point where you declare victory. There's a winner. You won. The rules are very different from finite and infinite games. And we often treat them the same. And they're not. And this book gets into that. And it is really fascinating.
Cool. Mine is a little less deep. I was going to talk about 99% Invisible is running a little mini series right now that they just wrapped up on clothing that I am weirdly fascinated by. It's called Articles of Interest. And each week for 6 weeks, they just wrapped up, they take on an article of clothing and kind of explain why it is the way it is, from why do women's clothes not have pockets to why is literally half the planet on any given day wearing blue denim? And, you know, it's one of those stories, like, I'm not a clothes horse. I work from home. I am recording this like I do every week in my pajamas. But it's sort of a unconventional take on how the market shapes the things that surround us, in this case, the things that are closest to our bodies. And I'm finding it to be just a total treat, and I wanted to recommend it today.
I've got one I want to share with you. Because I know this will interest you and actually make you a little bit jealous. So I told you my wife works for Minnesota Public Radio. I know you're a fan of the In the Dark series.
Yeah.
The podcast. So the In the Dark people who are, you know, part of American Public Media, which is Minnesota Public Radio, they are coming to Brainerd November 1st. Yeah. And giving a talk and doing Q&A. And I just, my wife has to go because it's like her beat, her like area and stuff. And she's going to be there. She told me about it and I'm like, cool, I might like to go to that. So I just signed up and I'm going November 1st. I'm going to be home and the kids will be at dance and I'm going to go. Yeah. So you're welcome to come up here and hang out.
I think I can make it up there from St.
Yeah,
Louis,
meet
but
the In the Dark
thank you for
crew.
The invitation.
Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, thanks so much for listening to UpZone. You can subscribe on iTunes or anywhere else you get your podcasts. And you can always become a member of the Strong Towns movement by visiting strongtowns.org/membership and telling the world that you think we deserve a better way to build. Thanks so much and keep doing what you can to build a strong town. Thank you.